Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, November 2, 2017, during a live teleform conference call.
Welcome to the Federal Society's teleform conference call. This afternoon, we are privileged to host Ambassador Robert Kimmitt as he discusses the role of the Treasury in national security policy. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Ambassador Kimmitt is Senior International Counsel and Co-Chair of the Strategic Response Group at the law firm WilmerHale. Ambassador Kimmitt, we are thankful that you are here with us today. The floor is yours until you are ready to take audience questions.
Great. Thank you very much for that introduction and also for the invitation. I want to also, as I've done on previous calls, compliment the good work of the Federalist Society. I think taking time from our day-to-day work to think about broader issues is part of what we do to make sure that we have both breadth of perspective and depth of contribution in our daily professional contributions. So today we will talk about Treasury's increasingly active and prominent role in the National Security Council, the National Security Council system. The National Security Council was created in the National Security Act of 1947. So it's celebrating its 70th anniversary this year. That same act, the National Security Act of 1947, created the Defense Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the CIA. The NSC, when it was established, was comprised as statutory members of the President, the Vice President, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, the Director of Central Intelligence, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Been one slight change in the interim, and that is the National Director of Intelligence has taken the place of the Director of Central Intelligence as the intelligence advisor. But until July of this year, the membership had stayed largely as it was back in those early days of 1947. The Act, interestingly, mentioned economics as an issue of national security concern. But, as I say, there was really no economic or financial representation on the Council in its early decades. And that was very much consistent with the tenor of the times during the early and later days of the Cold War, where military and diplomatic dimensions of national security policy dominated. But one thing that I think it's really important to understand is that national security is a dynamic concept. Interestingly, it's not defined in the National Security Act, and there's no agreed definition elsewhere in U.S. statutes. And that's good because, again, national security was one thing during the Cold War, quite another thing during the post-Cold War period, then post-9/11, post-financial crisis, and even has unique dimensions in the national security environment that we face today. I go back to my engineering training at West Point and think of national security in equational terms, and that is that it is foreign policy plus defense policy plus international economic policy, all divided by or resting on a strong intelligence base. And it is really hard to think of any country today, any issue today, that doesn't present itself with multiple dimensions of foreign policy, defense policy, international economic policy. And of course, we always need that strong intelligence input for any analysis or decision-making in the national security area. I would say in the last 10 years, particularly since the global financial crisis that started in the U.S. Just about 10 years ago today, you've seen a real growth in the international economic and financial policy dimension of national security policy. As a result, Treasury has been playing an increasing role, but always at the National Security Council as an invitee not as a member. So meetings of the NSC could go forward even if a Treasury rep were not available, but they couldn't go forward without the President, the Vice President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, and again, the two statutory advisors, the DNI and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Treasury, particularly since 2001, has been best known for its work in the sanctions area, both economic and financial sanctions, the work of OFAC, the Office of Foreign Assets Control, FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, really looking particularly closely at countries like Iran, North Korea, and Russia. The Treasury plays a national security role beyond sanctions. For example, Treasury has, since 1975, chaired the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., CFIUS, which reviews foreign acquisitions of companies in the United States to ensure that there's no damage to U.S. national security. Treasury also takes the lead in the key global governance bodies around the world, particularly the G7, the Group of Seven, and the G20, the Group of 20, trying to make sure that we are creating a stable, growing global economy, including in tough places like the Middle East, Africa, and elsewhere, where the lack of a strong economic foundation with jobs and opportunity is not only a human tragedy, but it's also a breeding ground, of course, for terrorist groups for their recruiting and operational purposes. So I sometimes shorthand it by saying Treasury's role is in national security is both punitive and positive. The punitive part of it is the sanctions piece. The positive part is the work done in the G20, the G7, and elsewhere on a bilateral basis too, trying to stand up healthy economies. So the Treasury watches economies closely throughout the world, both for how they're developing, but also what national security implications could arise from problems in a particular country or region's economy. I'll give you an example. In November of 2008, we were having a National Security Council meeting at the White House with President George W. Bush. Subject was Pakistan. Pakistan, as it often has been over the past 20 years, was in a very difficult political situation, a very difficult security situation, and both Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of Defense Bob Gates laid out those political and security concerns very well. But then I, as Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, representing the Treasury Department, put my hand up and said, in addition to those diplomatic and military concerns, let me say that Pakistan last night fell under 2 months of import cover. They are on the verge of a balance of payments crisis that could exacerbate both the political and security concerns presented by Secretaries Rice and Gates. Now, import cover is a technical term. It is the amount of foreign currency reserves a country needs to cover its imports. And in Pakistan's case, its principal imports for food and fuel. And if they get under 2 months of foreign currency reserves, it means they're coming very close to not being able to pay for essentials that they must import. What would have happened? Riots on the street. The Pakistani military and police would have gone out to try to quiet those riots. Al-Qaeda and other groups would have stirred the pot to try to make an already difficult security situation even more difficult. Well, the minute I made my presentation, the entire meeting pivoted to what could we do to avert a balance of payments crisis that would keep Pakistan from importing its needed goods, particularly food and fuel. And essentially what we did is we went first to the Asia Development Bank, of which Pakistan is part, and then to the World Bank to get bridge loans for Pakistan to get them through the crisis period. And then the first pledging conference that was held in the Obama administration in late January of 2009 was a global pledging conference where countries around the world, developed countries, offered to give Pakistan economic assistance in return for economic restructuring on their part. I think if I had not been at that NSC meeting, if Treasury had not been represented at that NSC meeting in November of 2008, I think that the balance of payments crisis would have snuck up on us. I think it would have hit Pakistan. We would have wondered why it hadn't been called to our attention. It would have been much harder to react. And so I think, again, we need to think of the Treasury function as really integral to national security, in addition to its important, very important role on domestic and international markets, economies, and productive societies. Now, the recent Russia-Iran North Korea Sanctions Act that was passed in July of this year on an amendment from the House Financial Services Committee, for the first time in 70 years, made the Treasury Secretary a statutory member of the National Security Council. This means that no longer will there be a question of whether to invite the Secretary of Treasury to meetings. He, or perhaps in the future she, will always have to be invited, and the question will be how to accommodate schedules to make sure that the three principal cabinet secretaries, State, Treasury, and Defense, are all present. So personally, I feel a lot better knowing that there'll be a Treasury person at the table who will be complementing the good work of the other departments and agencies, but looking closely at the economic and financial dimension of the national security question that is before the National Security Council. By the way, this also means that Treasury needs to have more representation abroad, and Treasury now has 24 Treasury attachés in key embassies throughout the world, and it also has representatives in the key military commands around the world. Because the National Security Council system operates on the basis of intersecting interagency circles, and there will be meetings in the Situation Room of the White House, there'll be meetings in the departments and agencies, but also the ambassador's table abroad and the four-star commander's table abroad is also an interagency table. And in those key countries and regions, you want to make sure that Treasury, as well as State and Defense, are well represented at all of those interagency tables. A recent example of this growing role of Treasury in the work of the National Security Council was the recently completed trip to the Middle East by Secretary of Treasury Steven Mnuchin. He went first to Israel, talked about a wide range of issues there, from sanctions on Iran, but also to economic development in the Palestinian territories, also internal economic development questions in Israel. He then moved on to the UAE, continued the discussion, particularly of sanctions against Iran, because at the end of the day, sanctions can only really be effective if they're multilateral and have particularly the participation of countries in the region. He then went to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia had a major investment conference. The new leadership there is trying to bring foreign direct investment into Saudi Arabia to provide, again, those jobs and opportunities for young Saudis that will hopefully keep them productively employed rather than lured away by extremist organizations. And again, I think if you look at the Mnuchin trip, it's a classic example, again, of that Treasury role, both on the positive side, let's stand up healthy economies, and the punitive side, if we have to make sure that sanctions are in place against countries like Iran, like North Korea, like Russia, who are stepping outside international norms. So we'll come to your question shortly. I will just conclude by saying that I think U.S. security is stronger when we leverage not only our military might, but also the strength of our markets. Our military is without parallel in the world. It has no peer. I would also say, though, that the U.S. market and marketplace and economy brings equal strength to the table, and both for a strong and prosperous country at home, but also a strong U.S. presence abroad, making sure that economics and finance, with Treasury on the point, is integral to the work of the government in the national security area, I think is going to be the real touchstone for national security success in the decades to come. Thank you for listening, and I look forward very much to your questions.
Thank you, Ambassador. Let's move to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter the star key and then the pound key on your telephone.
Hi, this is Josh Harlan, Harlan Capital Partners. Thank you very much for your comments. My question is the following. Many have observed that in a number of our military activities abroad, we've taken enormous time, effort, and expense to occupy entire countries in the Middle East, but the economic benefits that might flow from those activities have often seemed to be an afterthought. Do you think, as a matter of geoeconomics, that we should incorporate into our foreign and military planning the potential economic benefits that could be obtained in the areas in which we have activities and influence?
Thanks, Josh. The answer is absolutely yes. And I think you asked the question the right way, because it is a subject that we need to anticipate, say, in a pre-war planning setting. We have to then execute it, you know, well during the conflict even, but certainly it has to be an absolutely integral part of the post-war effort. When I was at Treasury in 2005, we would have meetings of the National Security Council on Monday mornings, and we would bring in by video conference the ambassador in Baghdad and the military commander in Baghdad. And we would have a good discussion of the political situation, post-war political situation, the post-war military situation. But the economic dimension was really just missing. And so I made a very strong push to make sure that when we had those Monday morning teleconferences, we also had someone from the embassy in Baghdad talking about the economic component. And State Department took that request very seriously. They moved a fellow named Charlie Reese, who was then our ambassador in Athens, Greece, a terrific career foreign service officer. They moved him into Baghdad to run the economic and financial component of what we were doing. And thenceforth, every Monday, we would hear from the ambassador, we'd hear from the military commander, then we'd hear from Charlie Reese about what we were trying to do to try to help the Iraqis build a strong economic base, even in the midst of the continuing post-war security difficulties. That would be first and foremost for the benefit of the Iraqis, but of course that base also encouraged U.S. firms to come in and work in Iraq. And I would say that our firms, because of the U.S. leadership, had pride of place in going after those opportunities, both U.S. oil firms, some defense contractors, service providers, and others. And during the surge period in 2007, people remember the very successful military surge. We had a corresponding but not very well-known economic surge where during 2007, we led an effort that came up with something called the International Compact with Iraq. And in return for Iraq taking some measures to strengthen their currency, strengthen their budgeting process, do a better job of denationalizing their economy, countries provided them assistance. It could be technical assistance. It could be debt relief, which they really needed so they could access capital markets. And so by the end of the surge in 07, going into early 08, not only had the security situation gotten better, but the currency had stabilized. The oil revenues were coming in and being dispersed better. Still many, many challenges to come, but it was right during that time and continuing to today that the Iraqis have begun to access debt capital markets, create better opportunities for U.S. and other firms. But you, again, ask the question the right way. This cannot be an afterthought. You need to have Treasury and Commerce and others involved in that pre-war planning. They need to be right alongside those people during the conflict who are preparing for the post-war period. I think when I was at Treasury, the largest Treasury attaché office in any country was in Iraq. We also had a good-sized one in Afghanistan. And so that economic financial component has to be integral, even as you say, in the post-war planning that goes on in tough security environments.
Thank you. That's very interesting.
Thank you, caller, for your question. These days, we hear more and more rhetoric on how war is too costly and that economic principles will bring us further towards peace, at least more peaceful world. Do you see that as a linear relationship?
I see it as a strong interconnected relationship, probably not a linear relationship. I think it is important to have people who understand economics and finance in our warfighting departments, that is defense, the services, and into the joint staff. I think the key thing is to make sure that the people with the expertise that is necessary are sitting around these interagency tables and bringing those perspectives to bear when those important decisions are being made. Interestingly, you will have seen what Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis said when he was a four-star commander. He basically said, you know, without more diplomatic and economic support, I have to buy more bullets. And his basic point was, we've got a terrific fighting force, but we can't do it on our own, and it will be disproportionately costly to the military if we don't have a whole-of-government approach that brings other U.S. strengths to bear. And again, I think our economic and financial strength is a particularly good lever in that regard. I would note one other thing for this group in particular. U.S. Treasury Secretary is the only G20 finance minister who doesn't also run his country's budget. The Treasury Department ran the U.S. budget up till the 1930s when the Bureau of Budget was created in the Office of the President. Now, of course, that functions with the Office of Management and Budget. Treasury participates at a macro level but does not any longer do the day-in, day-out budgeting work that is done by every other major finance ministry. And I say that because, of course, we want to have burden sharing, both when we defend but also when we fight our wars. So if we want other governments to do their share on defense spending, for example, pushing now for other NATO allies to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defense, well, then the person who's going to make that final decision in most cases in foreign governments is the finance minister, the counterpart of the U.S. Treasury Secretary. So even as the Treasury Secretary brings that economic and financial dimension to the table, he can help his defense and State Department colleagues by making sure that the counterparts, say, in Germany, in Japan, and elsewhere, who have to make those tough budget decisions, also get a nudge from their day-to-day counterpart as to why, again, in this whole of government, whole of the alliance setting, they need to do their part too.
Thank you. Let's move to our next audience question.
Hello, Ambassador. This is Matthew Byrne. I'm an attorney with Jackson Lewis, PC, and head of the Cincinnati Lawyers Chapter. My question is about the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which I guess is housed within Treasury or chaired by the Secretary of the Treasury. Do you have any thoughts on the role that the committee plays with regard to foreign investment, particularly now that we have a presidential administration that is at least perceived as being more protectionist in nature, and how does that fit in with our overall national security strategy?
Great question. And yes, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S., which reviews foreign direct investment by foreign acquirers of U.S. assets to make sure that any national security concerns are identified, is chaired by the Secretary of Treasury and has been since 1975. Interestingly, CFIUS was set up in 1975. This goes all the way back to the Ford administration because of a concern that recycled Saudi petrodollars we're going to be buying up major parts of the U.S. farm belt. In 1987 and 8, when people were quite sure that Japan was going to take over the world, Senator Jim Exton of Nebraska and Congressman Jim Florio of New Jersey put an amendment into the Defense Production Act that brought the Committee on Foreign Investment into the U.S. into a statutory framework, the Exxon-Florio Amendment. In 1992, when there was concern about the French government buying U.S. defense contractors, there was an amendment made to make purchases by government-owned entities tougher. In 2007, after the CNOOC effort to buy Unocal and the Dubai Ports case, there was passed the Foreign Investment National Security Act of 2007, which further strengthened the review process. So CFIUS has been around a long time. Just today, by coincidence, Senator John Cornyn and Congressman Bobby Pittenger from Charlotte, North Carolina, are introducing bills to further strengthen the work of CFIUS. They are particularly concerned about Chinese investment in the United States and some other administrative concerns they have about the way the CFIUS process is working. I would say, though, that your question captures a concern that I have, and that is we read a lot about the president's strong views on trade, having backed away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, wanting to renegotiate NAFTA, and a great concern about growing trade protectionism. I am actually more concerned about investment protectionism, that is, a growing hesitance to take investment from abroad that, in my view, is a real vote of confidence in the U.S. economy, creates good jobs and opportunity. Of course, we have to protect our national security. I served 17 months in combat in Vietnam. My dad served 2 years in combat in World War II, a year and a half in Korea. There's no one who believes more in protecting the national security than a combat veteran. And yet, at the same time, part of our security, too, is having a strong economy at home and those jobs and opportunity that are created by good foreign direct investment we don't want to lose, because today there are 7.5 million Americans who work in this country for companies headquartered overseas. Quite a few, by the way, in the Cincinnati area. And Senator Rob Portman always reminds me of that, a lot of German and other companies there. And those 7.5 million Americans are only 5% of our private workforce, but each year they produce 15% of all R&D spending, 20% of our exports. The jobs pay 25% more, and they're about one-third in manufacturing versus only about 15% of the overall economy. So these are jobs we want to fight for. I think we should start with a commitment to open investment as well as free trade, but then have a CFIUS process that looks carefully to make sure someone is not abusing our openness to make strategic gains against the United States. So I'm very much in favor of the CFIUS process, but I also don't want to kill the golden goose. And as my boss Jim Baker used to say when we were at Treasury in the Reagan years, foreign direct investment is our ace in the hole. That is capital saying that they believe in the American marketplace, the American worker, the American rule of law, and we want to get as much of that investment as we can that doesn't harm U.S. national security.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you, caller, for your question. Seeing that there are no more questions in the queue, Ambassador, is there anything that you would like to comment on before we finish?
No, I'd just like to say again, my career has been one where I've been expected to deliver in depth every day, and each one of us has that responsibility, whether it be to our clients, to our institutions. But I also try every day to broaden my perspective a little bit, to think about things that are not part of the day-to-day responsibilities, but that might be particularly important to me in the future. And so I very much compliment people who have taken time out today for this call. I compliment the great work of the society in making sure that people have an opportunity to think beyond their day-to-day jobs. And thank you very much again for the opportunity.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I'd like to thank you, our expert, for the benefit of your valuable time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. This call is now adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.